The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome to Noah Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights and resources available. Our goal, to empower and put you in charge of your case. I'm your host, Attorney Noah Davis, broadcasting live from the studios of KLAY 1180 AM in Tacoma, Lakewood, Washington, on this gorgeous day. Be sure to check out our website at www.noahyourrights.com as we post the audio for each show, as well as follow-up information on each program. You can also visit clay1180.com for more information on me, this show, and additional programming on your conversation station. This is episode 25 of Know Your Rights, and today is a special edition of our show. Independence Day, July 4th, 1776, the day our Continental Congress announced that the 13 American colonies were a new nation, the United States of America. As we prepare to celebrate the birth of this nation, we also look back, starting 243 years ago, all the way back to 1765, a time when the colonies were inflamed over taxes imposed on them by the British, including the stamp tax and the tea tax. At the time, there was great anger over taxation without representation, as it was called. And as protests gained momentum, more British troops were sent to quell distress and protect British assets. You'll no doubt remember the Boston Tea Party, which came in 1773, with colonialists dressed as Native Americans to dump British tea worth about $1 million in today's money into the port waters in the Boston Harbor to protest the tax and monopoly by the British East India Company. Even John Hancock's merchant ship was seized as being an illegal trade runner after British customs officials believed that Hancock had unloaded 3/4 of his cargo at night to avoid paying duties. Hancock was charged as a smuggler and became a vocal enemy of the crown. Later, when he signed the Declaration of Independence, he was not afraid of the retribution, as Hancock's signature is the most prominent. And of course, it's also where we get the saying, sign your John Hancock right there. And in 1770, in what became perhaps one of the earliest debates over competing versions of the news, today we have the fake news debate, of course, 9 soldiers of the regular British Army fired on an angry mob in 1777 of some 100 colonialists that had surrounded them and had pelted them with snowballs, stones, and even clubs. From the volley that was returned at the protesters, 5 were killed. In London, the event was called the Incident on King Street. In America, it became known as the Boston Massacre. As a result of the ensuing uproar, 9 soldiers that were involved in the Boston Massacre were arrested and charged with murder. In an ironic twist, the future second president of the United States, John Adams, defended the British officers. He artfully selected the jury of British loyalists, which resulted in acquitting 6 of those soldiers. 2 were found guilty of a manslaughter charge and sentenced to branding on their hand. John Adams, as you may recall, he was a famous lawyer at the time in the colonies. He was the cousin of the revolutionary agitator and great, and also after the beer that's pretty prominent these days, to Mr. Samuel Adams. Paul Revere was so angered, you'll remember that name, Paul Revere was so angered by the April 1770 shooting, the Boston Massacre, that he helped create a drawing or engraving of the event, the very famous depiction that showed British troops mercilessly lining up to shoot a peaceful group of colonialists. That picture, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words, that picture became a symbol of tyranny and oppression, a symbol of the growing revolution. In 1775, with Massachusetts a hotbed of activity and actually branded by the crown as a colony in rebellion, the British troops were sent in to quell, the unrest, destroy illegal munitions, and arrest some of the leaders. When members of the Continental Congress, who had meetings secretly often, learned of the plan to disarm the militias, arrest Samuel Adams and John Hancock for treason against the crown, on April 18, 1775, they dispatched messengers Paul Revere and Samuel Prescott from Boston to Lexington to warn the militias and tip off Hancock and Adams. One lantern was lit if the British were coming by land, two lanterns if by sea. And of course, the cry long attributed to Paul Revere, the British are coming, the British are coming. Paul Revere made it to Lexington on that ride, but not Concord, as he was arrested on the way. The next day, April 19th, 1775, some 80 colonial militiamen emerged from a tavern in Lexington. That was often the meeting place. Emerged from a tavern in Lexington to stop the march of some 700 regulars of the British Army. They were no match, of course, and they had five killed that afternoon. But the skirmish was the shot heard round the world. It was the first shot of the Revolution. And definitely, the word spread across the state of Massachusetts, the colony of Massachusetts at the time. Militiamen all throughout the colony began to rise up. As the British Army marched from Lexington to Concord, and then retreated back to Boston, that force, because it was reinforced, grew to around 1,700. But the ranks of the militia swelled too, from 800 to more than 4,000 during the march. There was constant skirmishing during that day, including house-to-house fighting and periodic ambushes by the colonialists. There was even one occasion where a group of over 60-year-old militiamen who weren't allowed into the regular militia surrounded a group of British regular officers who continued to march and disobeyed the militiamen's order to stop. And the older group of militiamen actually fired on them and killed a number of the British regulars and captured them. That was the force that was fighting that day. They came from everywhere across the colony. They rose up after the first shots were fired, and they came together. The 4,000 grew to 15,000 that followed the army back to Boston. In total that day, the colonials lost 49 killed and 39 wounded. The British lost 73 killed and 174 wounded. While it's not a battle of major casualties, it was the start of the war. There was no turning back now. During the next year, the colonials lost at Bunker Hill, but they caused great casualties to the British. The new Continental Army also invaded Canada and failed. But despite those failures, by July of 1776, the next year, under a new commander, General George Washington, the colonialists had taken control of all 13 colonies. The time was now. The time was to act. On July 2nd, after much debate, the new Congress, Second Continental Congress, took a major step. They voted for independence, July 2nd, 1776. The vote wasn't actually announced until 2 days later when wording of the Declaration of Independence could be agreed upon. A simple vote wasn't enough, as you can imagine. This was a momentous occasion. It demanded historic prose. At the time, on July 2nd, Founding Father John Adams, he had written that day to his wife, that July 2nd would forever be etched into the sacred history of America and revered for generations with pomp and parades. He was close, wasn't he? John Adams was right about the pomp and parades, but of course it was July 4th, the day the great words enshrined in the Declaration of Independence was finalized, signed and introduced. That day became our official Birth of a Nation Day, not July 2nd. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to abolish it and to institute new government. Coming up next, we're going to fast forward to another important chapter of our young nation. A test like no other. The Civil War. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Deal Talk. To make sure my new Spicy Chicken Club combo is a great value, I asked a sales expert.
It's amazing, Jack. You get a spicy, crispy chicken breast, hickory smoked bacon, and melted cheese on toasted sourdough, plus fries and a drink. All in one delicious deal.
You said it, Stanley.
Ow. Wait, what's happening?
Stanley? Stanley, you're deflating!
I'm so cold.
We need a doctor!
Jack, tell my wife I love her.
No! Try my new Spicy Chicken Club combo. Another great deal from Jack in the Box.
Hi, I'm Noah.
from Know Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.knowyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@knowyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
This is you over 30 years ago.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
And this is your mom when you drive her back from therapy.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
Roles change without us noticing, and in your new role, we help you help. AARP gives you the information to help care for your mom so that you can have patience with her just like she did with you. Visit aarp.org/caregiving or call 1-877-333-5885 to get practical health and wellness tips to provide even better care for your loved one.
Are we there yet?
Remember, visit aarp.org/caregiving. AARP, we help you help. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Habeas corpus, a Latin phrase roughly translated as free or protect the body. It's a legal principle that allows a person wrongfully detained or imprisoned to petition the court to determine the lawfulness of the arrest. The principle was adopted from England by the New America. It's a sacred legal remedy in America, one of our most important. But just like the survival of the new nation, this right was under attack during the Civil War. The setting is 1861. And joining us on this special edition of Know Your Rights to talk about the events of 1861 is attorney Gene Barton from Carr Tuttle Law Firm in Seattle. Gene, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show, Noah.
With the outbreak of the war, the riots, so much uncertainty, and Washington, D.C. in the middle of the South, located geographically, Lincoln faced a number of challenges, didn't he?
That's true. To set the scene, if I can, it was just 2 weeks after the first shots of the Civil War were fired at Fort Sumter on April 2nd, 1861, and Lincoln was facing an intense dilemma. The South, in the embodiment of Virginia, was essentially in his backyard. It lay in view from the White House portico, just across the Potomac River, and Maryland, which supposedly was a neutral state, was actually an unruling slave-holding state that surrounded the Capitol. Intrigue and its constant companion, suspicion, lurked around every corner and hung in the air like a damp summer miasma around D.C. Shots had already been fired in the area. Lives had been lost in Baltimore on April 19th when a mob attacked a train carrying Union soldiers. And it's, you know, what's a president to do? On the evening of April 19th, that night when the train was attacked, the Maryland governor by the name of Thomas Hicks and the Baltimore mayor, a fellow by the name of George William Brown, ordered the destruction of the railroad bridges leading into the city from the north to prevent further incursions by Union soldiers. And the destruction was accomplished the next day on April 20th. This obviously caused President Lincoln additional worry concerning a direct and serious threat to the Capitol. Lincoln delegated limited authority to the Army to suspend the writ of habeas corpus in Maryland, which is really an unusual act of the presidency. It wasn't done again until World War II. On April 27th, Lincoln told his general, William Winfield Scott, who was the commanding general of the Union Army, that the, quote, officer in command at the point was authorized to suspend habeas corpus if there was any resistance on the military line from Annapolis to Washington. And as things escalated, on May 13th, another Union general, this time Benjamin Butler, entered Baltimore by rail. Somehow they got around those blown-up bridges. Arrived with 1,000 federal soldiers, took possession of Federal Hill, and trained his guns upon the city. He marched on to occupy Baltimore and declared martial law. So that's where we were at that point in time in the early onset of the Civil War. But may I step back just a bit to give your listeners a little more background about habeas corpus?
Absolutely.
If you take some time reading your Constitution, you'll find the embodiment of habeas corpus in Article 1, Section 9, which states, "The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it." So this is what President Lincoln is looking at this point in time. There is rebellion. The Civil War has started. The South is pointing its guns at Washington, D.C., and General Butler is aiming his cannons at the city of Baltimore. As Noah mentioned, habeas corpus comes from English law dating back to the 14th century. Unlike other parts of the Constitution, which were designed to counter British colonial policies that irked the colonists, such as the Third Amendment, we have this arcane provision, but it comes from the Revolution. It states, "No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law." This was based upon the quartering of British soldiers in the homes of the good people of Boston and other areas. They had to put up these soldiers and feed them and give them a place to sleep without any compensation. So we get this sort of retribution in the Constitution itself. Section 9 of the Constitution, where we do find the habeas corpus clause, actually contains a hodgepodge of other provisions, as if Constitutional Convention, they were just throwing ideas out at the time, and they started putting them here in Section 9. This includes the Emolument Clause, which we've heard about recently, and the Slavery Sunset Provision, which states, "The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. You read between the lines, they're talking about slavery. Of course, Congress didn't vote to extinguish slavery in 1808. Of course, that didn't happen until after the Civil War. And so that takes us back to Baltimore under martial law in April 1861, where the Confederate sympathizers and those critical of Lincoln were rounded up and arrested, including Baltimore Mayor George William Brown, as we mentioned, among those who had ordered destruction of the railroad bridges. Now, despite the imprisonment of these key officials, there was a militia captain, a fellow by the name of John Merryman, who had been involved in the destruction of the bridges, whose name would become synonymous with habeas corpus law in the United States. Now, for reasons lost to history, it was Merriman's case and not Mayor Brown's case or that of some other high official that caught the attention of Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Taney. He was a Maryland native, and at the time, members of the Supreme Court could take the bench in the federal circuit courts. So he stepped in to the federal circuit court in Maryland, in Baltimore, to act as the judge to hear Merriman's case. And he quickly issued a writ of habeas corpus on Mary Mann's behalf on May 26th to order him released from Fort McHenry, where he had been imprisoned. But he remained there in defiance of the writ. The federal government refused to produce the body of Mr. Merriman. Upon issuing the writ, Chief Justice Taney had ordered another Union general, one George Cadwallader, who was the commander of the military district, including Fort McHenry, to appear in court on May 27th with Merriman in tow. The general failed to appear. Instead, he sent a colonel to explain that the Army had suspended the writ of habeas corpus under Lincoln's order, as well as providing a letter explaining the circumstances of Merriman's arrest and requesting an extension to reply so that he could get further instruction from President Lincoln. Well, unbent and unswayed, Chief Justice Taney was not having any of that. He not only refused the general's request, but held him in contempt of court. Taney issued a writ of attachment for the general and ordered a U.S. Marshal to seize him and bring him to court on the 28th. However, the marshal, not surprisingly, was denied entry into Fort McHenry, so he couldn't get at General Cadwallader, and the writ was not served. So, on May 28th, Chief Justice Taney, carrying on before an empty courtroom, ruled that Merriman's imprisonment was unconstitutional, absent congressional authorization, which Lincoln could not obtain since Congress was in recess. He adjourned the court on the 28th, and with quill in hand and candle lit, Taney issued his ruling on June 1st. Simply put, Taney stated the president, under the Constitution and laws of the United States, cannot suspend the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus, nor authorize any military officer to do so. In short, he ruled that only Congress had this had the authority to suspend habeas corpus. Conjuring the ghost of Thomas Jefferson, Taney looked back at a time when the issue had arisen under Jefferson's presidency. This was during the conspiracy of which Aaron Burr was the head. And at that time, it justified, in Mr. Jefferson's opinion, according to Chief Justice Taney, to suspend the writ of habeas corpus on his own authority, but communicated his opinion to Congress with all proofs in his possession, rather than issuing the order himself, that Congress might exercise its discretion upon the subject and determine whether the public safety required it. And in the debate which took place upon the subject, no one suggested that Mr. Jefferson might exercise the power himself if, in his opinion, the public safety demanded it.
Well, at this time, while Washington, D.C. is becoming surrounded, troops from the South are marching on the Capitol, Abraham Lincoln suspends the writ of habeas corpus, or the ability to petition for habeas corpus, and the judiciary is in turmoil. You're listening to Noah, Your Rights. You're listening to a special edition of our show for July 4th. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on habeas corpus.
Deal Talk. To make sure my new Spicy Chicken Club combo is a great value, I asked a sales expert.
It's amazing, Jack. You get a spicy, crispy chicken breast, hickory smoked bacon, and melted cheese on toasted sourdough, plus fries and a drink. All in one delicious deal.
You said it, Stanley.
Ow. What's happening?
Stanley, you're deflating!
I'm so cold.
We need a doctor!
Jack, tell my wife I love her.
No! Try my new Spicy Chicken Club combo. Another great deal from Jack in the Box.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there, see how we can help you, and if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Some statistics are surprising. Some are unbelievable. and some are simply unacceptable. Right now, nearly 30% of U.S. students aren't finishing high school. Nearly 30%. And that's the average. In many places, it's even higher than that. And fixing it is a responsibility that we all share. This is President Obama, and I urge everyone, not just parents, but friends and neighbors and family members, to take responsibility for encouraging the high school students in your communities, to support them, challenge them, push them a little, and do whatever it takes to help them make it through. Because this is one statistic we simply can't afford to ignore.
You can do your part by going to boostup.org and sending an email, a text message, or even a wake-up call to a student at risk of dropping out. Go to boostup.org and provide the boost that's needed to make it to graduation. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, a show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights resources available to you. This is a special edition of Know Your Rights. It's our July 4th edition. We're talking habeas corpus. On the phone with us today is Gene Barton from the law firm of Carr Tuttle in Seattle. We're talking about a special time in the history of America in respect to habeas corpus. It's the Civil War. It's the beginning of the Civil War in 1861. Troops from the South are marching on the Capitol. There are cities in unrest. Abraham Lincoln's unsure of who's loyal to the Union and who dissents in the South. He's unsure of the direction the war is going to take. He's unsure of the solidarity that's behind him. He's unsure of which way to turn, which way to go. As the fight ensues, as the battles grow, Lincoln suspends the ability of persons arrested by the military, arrested by the government, arrested by Lincoln's charge. He suspends the ability of people to petition to the court to determine whether or not they're being held unlawfully. He wants to be able to hold folks indefinitely without a court hearing. He wants to make sure that rioters are put into custody immediately and they're not able to agitate anymore. But there's a Supreme Court justice that sees that, that sees the writ, that sees the federal court issue its concern about the constitutionality of Lincoln's actions. And the Supreme Court justice takes this very unusual step, definitely in today's world, of stepping from the Supreme Court down to the circuit court to rule on this, to issue commands to the military to produce Mr. Merryman, to produce him to court. And ultimately, this judge, the Supreme Court Justice, Roger Taney, finds Lincoln's act as unconstitutional or without authority of Congress. Gene, I hope I summarized that well enough and maybe brought us back up to date. It seems that the next stop for Lincoln in this battle with the courts, and it's an unusual battle because the Civil War, you have war unfolding, you have people picking sides in this battle over slavery, over the Union, over secession, and you have the judiciary standing up, despite it being a Union judiciary standing for the Union, it's standing up for an individual right, and it's on the opposite side of Lincoln.
And you know, as we talked about Lincoln, as you mentioned, Lincoln was standing strong, and he disobeyed the order. He simply would not make Merryman or anybody else let go if under the habeas corpus standard. he simply ignored Taney's ruling and. The right of habeas corpus to have that hearing that you've talked about essentially remained suspended throughout the war. But Lincoln made sure that he followed Chief Justice Taney's direction. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus nationwide on September 24th, 1862, and Congress, now in session, conforming to Judge Taney's ruling ratified the president's action on March 3, 1863, thereby passing what was called the Habeas Corpus Suspension Act. And so it continued through the entirety of the Civil War until that act was lifted upon the Union's victory.
And so what followed with the habeas corpus suspension act, what happened to Merryman and what ultimately happened with the ruling from the court?
Well, you know, I haven't followed up on what happened to Merryman himself. I imagine he was probably released before the end of the war and went on about his duties. He was a captain in the Maryland militia, so he was most likely to be fighting on the side of the South. That's a good question. I know he may be lost to history. I can tell you that there haven't been cases like this. There've been cases with respect to the prisoners at Guantanamo after 9/11, when George Bush, President Bush, tried to impose or suspend habeas corpus, and he was unsuccessful in doing so. The court ruled against him. There's something prescient that was written a few years after the Merryman case. There was another fellow by the name of Milligan who was being tried by a military court-martial, which had taken over authority of the local the area around Indianapolis in October of 1964, and his case made it to the Supreme Court as well. And there's a passage coming out of that Milligan decision which speaks not only to habeas corpus, but a warning from Justice David Davis, who wrote the opinion there. And he speaks of Lincoln and he speaks of Jefferson, as Roger Taney did. And he says, you know, we talking about the dangerous powers that a president can wield. And he says, this nation, as experience has proved, cannot always remain at peace, and has no right to expect that it will always have wise and humane rulers, sincerely attached to the principles of the Constitution. Wicked men, ambitious of power, with hatred of liberty and contempt of law, may fill the place once occupied by Washington and Lincoln, and if this right is conceded, and the calamities of war again befall us, the dangers to human liberty are frightful to contemplate.
I think Thomas Jefferson once said that the tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of tyrants from time to time. So a similar thought. We had some radical forefathers, but they were right, weren't they? You had to protect these rights at all costs, because if you didn't protect them, if you didn't stand up for these individual rights, there would be despots, there would be tyrants that would come along to suspend these rights, and they would try to gain power or to orchestrate their power in a way that they could accumulate more of it, and that they could either degrade the other branches of government or take away the checks that are available to the other branches of government. And our government, because of the Revolutionary War, because of the relations with England, we had been so concerned of the tyranny, of that taxation without representation, of the quartering of troops, of being taken advantage of not having a voice, of being told what to do without having a say in it. And so we set up a system of laws, a system of government that would protect individual rights while providing order to the chaos.
I couldn't agree with you more.
So the Milligan case, you know, as you mentioned that, I think about Guantanamo Bay, and I think about the fight that we've had internationally against these different terrorist organizations, and then in Afghanistan, these detainees are brought back to U.S. soil in Cuba, and then they're detained indefinitely. although I can't say to profess a lot of knowledge about the court proceedings and the battles over how you try those individuals, but I bet the Milligan case was a center point of that.
You know, it certainly has words in Justice Davis's opinion that ring loudly over 150 years later.
Yeah, and the fact that the court said in Milligan that if there are civil courts operating in the U.S. and if you suspend habeas corpus, if you do that constitutionally with an act of Congress, so with the support of Congress, you still cannot try those individuals in a military court. They still have the right to be tried in a civil court. And I think that's an important passage from Milligan.
That's correct, yeah.
Well, stay with us. Gene, I just have a couple questions I want to ask in follow-up. You're listening to Know Your Rights on Clay, 1180 AM.
Deal Talk. To make sure my new Spicy Chicken Club combo is a great value, I asked a sales expert.
It's amazing, Jack! You get a spicy, crispy chicken breast, hickory smoked bacon, and melted cheese on toasted sourdough, plus fries and a drink. All in one delicious deal!
You said it, Stanley.
Ow. Wait, what's happening?
Stanley, you're deflating!
It's so cold!
We need a doctor!
Jack, tell my wife I love her.
No! Try my new Spicy Chicken Club combo. Another great deal from Jack in the Box.
Hi, I'm Noah from Know Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.knowyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@knowyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and of course, companionship.
And what breed would you say Satchmo is?
I'd have to go with maybe a lavish terrier-hound-chihuahua-looking kind of mix.
Tremendous dog.
I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle, simply marvelous.
You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this.
Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group.
And finally, the loving face lick.
It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks.
Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. Make sure you check out our website at www.knowyourrights.com. You can also email me at noah@knowyourrights.com. Let us know what type of legal issues you have or that you want us to talk about, what type of resources that we can add to the website. I've heard from many of you about bankruptcy, real estate, and civil matters such as collection activity, defending against collections, defending against foreclosures, defending against credit reporting related issues, and I'm happy to get some speakers on the shows in ensuing shows. For today's show, we're talking July 4th. It's a special edition. We're celebrating the birth of our nation, July 4th, 1776. We started the show talking about the events leading up to the Declaration of Independence, the first shots of a Revolutionary War, the agitators known as patriots, agitators known by the British, known here as patriots, who stood up for this nation, who were willing to take a stance, to put their life on the line. We then skipped ahead 100 years to talk about the beginnings of the Civil War in 1861, President Lincoln suspending the writ of habeas corpus, a constitutional right, a constitutional procedure that we have, that those that are detained, that believe that they're detained unlawfully, can petition the courts for a hearing on whether or not the arrest or detention was lawful. A very important right, habeas corpus is. In 1861, there were a lot of events unfolding that made Lincoln take unusual courses to do what he thought was best to secure the nation. One of those was to suspend one of the most important laws. But the justice system stood up and stood out and against Lincoln to say, President Lincoln, yeah, this is the Civil War. These are times of great concern for our new nation. But habeas corpus and rights like these are not to be lightly trounced upon. You didn't have congressional approval. You didn't have the constitutional authority to suspend this in the way that you did. John Merryman should be released, and we order that he be released. Lincoln disobeyed that order. The Civil War raged on. With me on the phone is Gene Barton. He's been talking about the history of habeas corpus in this instance, the Suspension of Habeas Corpus Act, President Lincoln's treatment of this military detainee. We talked about the Milligan case too. You know, something else, Gene, when we took the break, I was thinking about, you know, how unusual was it at the time for a Supreme Court justice to step down from the Supreme Court and, well, not step down, but to fill a role on a circuit court to make a ruling on a case that might end up coming before him again on the Supreme Court?
That's an interesting construct, but you know, as far as my, you know, I haven't read about this thoroughly, but this is the only instance I'm aware of where a justice of the Supreme Court, let alone the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, has stepped down to the circuit court of any in any district to rule on a case. It might have been more common back in the day, back in the 1860s, if there were not judges otherwise available, but you're certainly not going to see that happen now.
There was also, I was thinking during the break, there was other things, there were a lot going on, of course, at this time, the Civil War. And for those of you that have had the opportunity to visit the Lincoln Memorial and Lincoln Library in Springfield, Illinois, it is an amazing place to visit. It is, it encapsulates the history of the Civil War, but it also encapsulates the life of Lincoln, how difficult his journey was from Kentucky to Illinois, and then self-taught as a lawyer, which was common in the time, traveling the circuit in Illinois, which he did, and the lawyers all traveled together, and they would ride the circuit. And I guess that's where, in part, we get the name circuit, but they did it this, they rode a circuit from courthouse to courthouse with the judges, and they would spend the night in the same inns and have drinks at the same taverns as the judges, all the lawyers would. And he practiced in Illinois for a number of years before he went into the legislature and then on to the presidency. And it talks about that at the library. One thing that we don't often hear about is how much political grief he received and how he was treated by the press at the time, because the pictures in the papers, and these were major papers, painted him as a monkey. Painted him as the devil, often because of his positions on slavery and positions in favor of the Union. It was a really difficult time to be president, to be a leader of this nation at the time. And so for those of you that have not ever had the chance to visit that library, it is an amazing experience, and I really would encourage you to try to visit it for that history. You know, something else that Lincoln did at the time that he ascended to the presidency, he appointed one of the judges that he did the circuit with, he appointed them to the Supreme Court of the United States. That justice then ruled on one of the most important decisions that Lincoln had issued or that Lincoln had made in the early presidency. And I think that was on the validity of the election or his presidency. I was trying to look for that information right now, but that's a different world than we live in today when we talk about conflicts of interest. You appoint a judge that you've argued before, you appoint him to the Supreme Court of the United States, and then that same judge, who's now a justice, rules on a case in your favor. That's a different world than we live in now.
And that's true.
So is there anything else to wrap up on the habeas corpus story? It seems that after the Civil War ended, this ruling still continued on, and in fact, the Habeas Corpus Act, the suspension was revoked by, I believe it was Andrew Johnson, President Johnson, except for the South, because they were still under military law, so habeas corpus was still suspended there.
Yeah, I think the justice that Lincoln appointed you were talking about is actually Justice Davis, who ruled in the Milligan case.
Yeah, interesting. It might have been Justice Davis. That sounds familiar too.
He was from Illinois.
So things were a little bit different back in the 1860s, and you know, it's even though things were treated differently, and maybe the conflicts of interest weren't the same as they are now, for the most part, they got things right. There were a lot of decisions, the Dred Scott case, the Missouri Compromise. There were a lot of things that they didn't get right. There were a lot of things that that weren't necessarily historically, you know, obviously, especially with respect to slavery, that they got wrong. But for the most part, on a lot of these issues, they did try to look into the future and do what was right.
Yeah, and it worked with respect to the Guantanamo Bay case. And as far as what Justice Taney was saying in 1861, worked after the September 11th attacks, and the Supreme Court of the United States overturned President Bush's attempt to place the Guantanamo Bay prisoners outside the jurisdiction of habeas corpus. So 150 years later, it's still strong.
Gene, when you're not helping Noah on Know Your Rights talk about the history on July 4th of events like Lincoln's suspension of the habeas corpus in 1861, what areas of practice do you have in Carr Tuttle in Seattle?
Well, I help people who are who have been sued, or I help people who want to sue somebody. It's called litigation for the listeners. So I'm a litigator. I represent plaintiffs and defendants in court.
How's the best way for people to reach you if they want to talk to you, reach out to you?
Well, they can go to our website with cartuttle.com here in Seattle, or they can contact me by email at gbarton@cartuttle.com.
And can I put that information up on our website if people want to go there and try to link to you from the NOAA Your Rights website?
Sure thing.
All right. Well, Gene, thank you so much for joining us on this special July 4th edition. We really appreciate your knowledge of the Habeas Corpus Suspension Act and President Lincoln and the context you provided us.
Thank you, Noah.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
Three of the founding fathers died on July 4th, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, who both signed the Declaration and perished July 4th, 1826, followed by James Monroe on July 4th, 1831. All three of those men served as president. You often hear the 13-gun salute that comes from the 13 original colonies and a practice begun in 1777. Big bonfires were often the night before the 4th to welcome in the 4th, as opposed to having fireworks the night of. So they were on the 3rd, the night of the 3rd. In 1779, because July 4th fell on a Sunday, which was a sacred religious day for our forefather, our early Christian nation, Independence Day celebration was moved to July 5th. I'm not sure everyone got the memo that year, though. It took nearly 100 years until 1870 for Congress to declare July 4th as a federal holiday, 68 more years before it became a paid holiday. Thanks for joining us for this last hour of Know Your Rights on this special July 4th edition. July 4th, Independence Day, special day, the birth of our nation. Let us not forget the many people that have come before us that sacrificed so much to give us the freedoms, the stability, the government, the lives that we have. On this July 4th, be safe, but remember those that came before us. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting Know Your Rights on Clay, 1180 AM. We'll see you next week.